Welcome to Water for Fighting. We discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This episode's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator, protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at seaandshoreline.com. And of course, Res. Res is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at res.us. If you enjoy the discussions here on Water for Fighting, I think you'll also want to check out the Florida Specifier and the Florida Specifier podcast. Specifier has become Florida's environmental news source of record, and the podcast is your go-to place for staying up to speed on environmental news and newsmakers here in the Sunshine State. You can join the discussion as we explore the latest environmental news and developments that matter to you. Go to www.floridaspecifier.com to check it out. All right, so let's get to know our guests, shall we? I'm joined today by someone who has a wide-ranging career here in Florida, but who may be best known at the moment for her work on restoring the Ocklawaha River. Margaret Spontak is the founder and executive director of the Great Florida Riverway Trust, an organization dedicated to the reconnection and restoration of four ecosystems: the Ocklawaha River, Silver Springs, the Lower St. Johns River, all the way down to the Atlantic Ocean, or up if you're looking at north-south rather than what's downstream. Margaret, thanks so much for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about you and your family a little bit, because it's always kind of an interesting story with most people that are Floridians. They tend to be related to folks who were not necessarily Floridians. Your parents are from New Jersey, right?
Yes.
Did they both grow up in New Jersey, first of all?
Yes, they grew up and met at New Jersey, Jersey State Teachers College. I don't think it's called that anymore. And they drove down here when my brother was about two, my oldest brother, in a Jeep with not a lot of money, and lived in Chiefland for a while, and then settled in Ocala for a long, long time. They were both teachers. Mom was a math teacher, and Dad was geography and history teacher.
Do you remember, and you must still have family in New Jersey, I would assume.
I don't. There are very few that are still living there, and Mom was a city girl. She was raised in Jersey City.
Okay.
And Dad was a farm boy raised in Pennington, New Jersey, which is near Trenton. And then we had some people that lived on Red Bank and different places, but pretty much lost track. Most of those folks are no longer with us, and lost track of a lot of our relatives up that way.
It's funny, it wasn't until recently, in the last decade or so, where you discovered it's not all Jersey City and Elizabeth and, you know, Newark. There's an actual reason why they call it the Garden State, which is a lot of open land and a lot of farm territory. So that's interesting that they met and connected and got together. But the real question for me is not just why did they come to Florida? That happens a lot, obviously. Why did they choose that part of Florida? That's not as common for people. You know, people go to Miami, Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville, but Chiefland and Ocala, that's a different story.
I think it was quite accidental. They drove down on probably 19 back then and was pretty much the main thoroughfare, ended up in this little city without a lot of money, and the principal let them camp their camper on school grounds until they raised enough money to get started. I mean, that would never happen today.
Right.
And then Dad wanted to get his master's at Florida. So they lived at Gainesville for a while and somehow settled in Ocala, probably just like the area. But I think the Chiefland thing was quite happenstance.
Mm. Marion County is a pretty big county, and it's also, I don't think a lot of people that don't know it don't realize that it's pretty wide-ranging in terms of your suburbs, and then there's very dense suburbs, and then there's the National Forest, and then there's lots of these awesome springs and rivers and things like that. Which part of the county was that?
So we pretty much were in historic Ocala, the center of the county. The county is they compare it to the state of New Jersey. It's a very big county, and that makes for a very expensive school transportation, lots of schools scattered everywhere. And yes, we have we're blessed that we're surrounded with kind of a green belt. On one side, the Ocala National Forest, and there's still residential, you know, parcels all over the forest area, and then beautiful horse farms on the other side. So we're lucky that we have that around us.
And so, I mean, talk to me about early childhood. I grew up in Hillsborough County, and some of my earliest memories were, you know, trips to Silver Spring State Park, to Rainbow River, you know, floating on that. Tell me about your early childhood and what that was like. You know, if you want to throw in, like, you know, siblings and things like that, I think we'll get to your brother John at some point, if that's okay. Talk about early childhood.
Well, one of our fondest memories, my dad, who was a teacher, built a cabin on National Forest lands. We still have that land in the family. And I'm just marvel that he built this. He did hire an electrician and a plumber, but it's built out of that old heart pine, and even today it's still standing strong. We spent, because I was married, I was family with two teachers, we had the luxury of having summers together to do whatever we wanted.
Yeah.
So up until middle school, when you want to be in town with all your buds, we spent the summers out in the lake in the National Forest, and kind of that probably started fishing when I was 3 or 4 years old, cane pole fishing and little Zebco and catching bass and brim. You know, I'll sound really a dinosaur. We did have a telephone, but we had very limited TV, if any. I don't think we even had a television for a longest time.
Wow.
So our entertainment was watching the flying squirrels flying at night, catching fireflies, you know, tadpoles. And we did get out on the rivers, some of the rivers, Ocklawaha, and of course Silver Springs. You could, I think back then, swim in Silver Springs for a quarter. So we that was a very special place for many of us. Always loved the outdoors. We would go to North Carolina, camping in the Smokies. We were very into the outdoors, the whole family was. And my family, I think I told you, we're a mixed family, half Presbyterian, half Catholic,
right,
half Gators, half Seminoles, and half Republican and half Democrat. That's changed through the years. But that made for interest. My dad loved to debate. And I'm the middle child, so I don't really get into arguments and debates too much. But my brother John and him used to debate things all the time. So
it makes Thanksgiving interesting, I guess.
Yes.
Well, I mean, was that a part of growing up? I mean, and I know that some folks do that. I came from a family of four kids as well, all ate dinner together every night unless someone, you know, you couldn't for some reason. And was that just a part of it? Was your dad, you know, making that a part of growing up, was being able to argue and come up with arguments?
I think that was very important to him. We were surrounded by books all the time, so we watched some television. When we would travel, they would always find maybe an outdoor theater program at a college or something like that. We didn't have a huge amount of money, so we went on one big trip to New York, which was a lot of fun memory, seeing the last Rockettes show, and they are now in business, and seeing John Wayne's big movies premiere. But mostly it was rural camping and trying to introduce us to museums and things along the way. So having teachers really opened things up. They really wanted us to learn about all kinds of things.
Tell me again what your parents taught.
So my mom was a math teacher, but she also in her early years taught biology.
Okay.
And my dad was geography and history.
Okay, so yeah, you get both ends. Then here's the natural world and how things work, and then here's the social science and how things have worked and how you argue about it. Interesting. At what point in your childhood did you kind of get a picture? And maybe you don't. It's like it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. Was there something that you were more attracted to in terms of subjects in school back then?
Oh, that's funny. We were talking about FSU earlier. I started out, actually, I took quite a bit of art in high school, and I got accepted to Ringling School of Art and chickened out, because back then their credits would not transfer if you decided that you wanted to make a change, so you couldn't change them, move them to FSU. I think now they can. But anyway, I just kind of got nervous about that. I started out as an art major. My parents, they were so wonderful. They always supported you on how wonderful you were in art. But I got at FSU and I looked around and I go, man, I'm in like the bottom 10% of the, you know, in terms of artistic talent. Right. And I'm like, I don't know about this. And so I literally changed majors four or five times. And my criteria was I'd look at the list and say, okay, what other creative area could I try?
Right.
So I was in art ed, art, and then art ed, and interior design, and there was one more, and then I landed on communications.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. Since its inception in 2014, Sea and Shoreline's unmatched experience with scientifically validated methods of aquatic restoration has proven successful across more than 150 environmental projects. The company continues to be the industry leader in rehabilitating threatened and corrupted aquatic environments with proven success in places such as Crystal River, Homosassa River, the Caloosahatchee River, and the Indian River Lagoon. I've seen firsthand how Sea and Shoreline completely reset the ecosystem in Crystal River, transforming from a mucky, algae-dominated system to one with plants that actually belong there. The water used to be full of lingbia and hydrilla, with a thick bottom layer of muck that smelled like rotten eggs. But with Sea and Shoreline's comprehensive muck removal and planting of native eelgrasses, the system is now beautiful, crystal clear, with lush eelgrass meadows. The manatees are feasting, fish have returned, ecotourism is booming, and property values have significantly increased. Sea and Shoreline is committed to restoring and preserving Florida's communities and aquatic ecosystems because they're Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to help your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation.
Did you find the hopping, and maybe it was later on you discovered it, but did you find that the hopping around ended up working to your advantage later
yes.
on to get that kind of dip in?
Yes. And simultaneously, I had the best experience in Tallahassee. Every year for three different years, I worked for a different state agency as what they call OPS, Other Personal Services. We started at DNR, it was then DNR, mm-hmm. and I literally, everything was manual, tracking the bills. We had this great big wall chart, and I carried the bills and journals all to the department directors and wow. learned about the legislative process. Second year, I worked for FWC, for Fish and Wildlife, and did their clip service back then. You clipped all yep. the newspaper articles, and I learned about media and all that. And then the final year, I worked for the film division over in Commerce and learned all about, you know, how you help people find locations. And then I worked some across the hallway with Commerce trying to set appointments with big companies on their trips out to California and such. So, oh my gosh, the combination of that.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I mean, going through, you know, your actual resume a couple of times, and that's starting to make sense now. It's like there is so many different things, and a lot of them it's tough to find, you know, that common thread. Is like, I think it's interesting that was your approach to education in that regard. I guess maybe getting to that part now is talking a little bit about where you were in terms of your education. You have private sector experience, you have academic experience that's in there, you have NGOs.
Right.
All of it seems to be mixed in there, communications experience. And I always try to draw, you know, patterns in my mind of, you know, trying to capture the essence of somebody, but you may be enigmatic in that way, in that maybe it's harder to capture, but tell me if I'm wrong here. It seems like communications, education, planning, it's all kind of seems to run through many of those. Yeah. Walk me through that work experience after school and tell me about some of that, and if that was kind of by design or your brain works that way in terms of how you choose and when you choose to make that next move.
Yeah, well, one thing, I get bored very easy, and I like to go in, at least in my, probably after the first few jobs, I love to go in where there's an opportunity to really change up things and do something really dramatically different. But I started out in communications, of course, worked at WXLT here, I think. Mm-hmm. It was WECA back there. I was a traffic manager. I don't go into that. But anyway, it was a good job, good paying job, and got me exposure in television, which was great. And then I moved to Ocala, and I such an odd way to do things, but I just picked like five places I wanted to work. I didn't know they had whether they had jobs or not. And one of them was Silver Springs, and one of them was the newspaper, mm-hmm. the college. Sent letters to all of them, got a couple of interviews, and ended up working with Silver Springs. They were owned by ABC originally, and it was Silver Springs and Wikiwachi. So very much communications, marketing, was head of sales and promotion for them. And I was involved with Florida Public Relations Association in the chapter there, mm-hmm. was president for the local chapter. Realized PR, per se, was somewhat of a glass ceiling. You could only, unless you're in a big city, it's kind of limiting, at least it was back then. So I decided to get my MBA. It was very intentional to try to move into more of a leadership management track. So did that and moved to the college, you know, in a community college, or the stakes are there now, CF, still in a marketing position. But because of my MBA and my background, I was able to move from that to, you know, Dean of Continuing Ed and corporate training,
right.
and all those. So it was very intentional trying to build my skills and kind of experience in a way that would be able to advance in a city at that time that wasn't huge, really huge. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I also commuted a lot. I had a job in Palatka for 6 years as a water management district head of policy and planning for St. John's, and then also commuted to Gainesville for their Leadership Institute. It was a way to get some really good positions that weren't always available in Ocala. And most of that variety of jumping around is kind of, not to sound boastful in any way, mostly I would run into people through one job and they would see something that I'd done and like the work I've done. And very rarely was I out scouting for jobs. It just, mm-hmm. I just was very attracted to doing something new and different. And unlike my husband, who owned a hardware store and stayed there his entire life, mm-hmm. I love to move around and meet new people, do exciting things.
Yeah, and well, I guess that's the thing I was going to ask you. Like, they seem like they were in different places, but was the gravitational pull, was home always going to be Ocala?
I think Ocala is kind of my leveling place, and even as I get older, I have just such dear friends there and connections. I think I'll be there for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. It's a kind of a special community. It really is. And I've really valued. There were times, though, for many of us who were raised in small towns, just dying to get out of that small town.
Right.
When we were in college, it was like, oh, I can't wait to get out of town. But I seem to always migrate back to my hometown.
I mean, does it still have, in your mind, and I've been to a bunch of different places there, and there still seems like there are places in Marion County that still have that very small town feel, and parts of it that's like every other, you know, large population, you know, county, Pinellas, Hillsborough, you know, Orange County.
Well, we are, I think, the fastest growing city, one of the fastest growing city, if not the fastest growing city in the United States right now, which is very scary. And the west part of the interstate is just going crazy with the World Equestrian Center coming in. And so it's really changing the, you know, the feel of that part of the community. Downtown is still just, it's been very vibrant for a long period of time, even through COVID. And the city has done amazing things to keep our downtown vibrant. So I do think that still kind of has that downtown feel. I think that I really landed in a beautiful community. It's a traditional neighborhood design, which may be the only community in Ocala that's built that way, where you have to have a porch. It's all sidewalks, small lots within open park areas in between. And everybody talks to one another. You know, you walk, it's very walkable, and people look out for each other. I chose this community, just built my house there. My husband died a few years ago. particularly just for that, to have that small town feel.
Nice. I guess one side question there. You said your husband passed, but the hardware store, is that still in the family? Did y'all sell it?
So the hardware store they sold, he was in his early 60s, I believe, and he and his brother owned it. And they sold it when Lowe's came in and Home Depot, and just got to be, just wasn't doing well. And so they sold it, and it's now a parking lot. I always think of the Joni,
that's right,
Joni song.
What was the name of, if you don't mind me asking?
It was Toffoletti Hardware, which was his mom's maiden name.
Okay.
Old Italian family that literally came over on the boat to Jacksonville and camped alongside the railroad tracks for I don't know how long. Mm. Till they got into the boarding house business and then got into the hardware business. And incredible success story of immigrants coming in and building their life there.
Yeah, sounds really cool. Let me go back to, you mentioned it already, the St. John's River Water Management District. I'm a water management guy. I've worked in other parts of government, but I worked at two water management districts.
Okay.
Not St. John's, unfortunately, good folks over there, and good folks, back then as well. Tell me a little bit more about your work there. And I want, if you don't mind, I'd like to for you to kind of intertwine your brother, John, who I knew a little bit back in the old days. I got to talk to him probably half a dozen times or so, but we didn't really, know each other. So I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about how maybe did your time had to have overlapped with each other.
No, but he was the one that convinced me to apply there. So my brother John had a land acquisition, bought hundreds of thousands of acres when he was there. He's quite legendary guy. I have two great brothers. I do want to say that. My brother Jim was Judge Jim Hankinson here, who was legendary in his role as judge and passed away not too long ago. So I do want to say they're both special, as well as my sister. But my John and I were very much alike, had a lot of common interests, and he kept on telling me, Margaret, you need to come work at the water. You'll love it. You need to come to the water management district. And I'm going, I just don't know. I don't know. They did have a marketing position there, but not a lot of things that I saw myself in. But I got involved in the comp plan process in Marion County when that was first getting started and we were doing our first comp plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally taught myself land use planning. I mean, I had a closet full of urban land planning stuff. I really learned all about that on my own and formed a group that we worked with 1,000 friends during the time and tried to do things in a very respectful, it kind of started the way I like to do things, which is not confrontational. I would walk out, be on the opposite side with the developers sometimes and walk out and shake hands and be talking to them about it. That's just how I like to do things.
Mm.
So I had all that experience, and I did go to apply for a marketing job there and got second on the interview. But one of the guys that was interviewing me said, I have another position coming up. It's director of policy and planning. And I go, well, I don't have any formal training in that. He said, yeah, but I've seen what you've been doing, in Marion County with comp plan process and everything. I think you'd be perfect. So I applied and got that job, and I've worked a lot of great places, but I was so amazed at the talent there. It was a lot different than it is now. Just there was more funding there for restoration, a lot more science staff. It was kind of a different era then. But I worked with Henry Dean was our ED, and he and I worked together so well. I learned so much from him. And that was the time we put together our first district water management plan, which is mandated by law. So our team, within 2 weeks of starting, we launched public meetings. In fact, they weren't going to do public meetings in advance. The typical way of doing things, and people still do it this way, is do a plan, a 300-page plan, finish it, take it out to the public, say, what do you think?
Yeah.
So I did really turn things upside down pretty quickly to say, let's go out and do some public meetings on what are the major issues that people are seeing in the water world.
Interesting.
And we got our vans and we did a road trip and we did public meetings in every county. And we had, 19 counties, Anyway, We did an amazing job, taught us so much about the people and the different issues. And then we took those issues and built from the ground up our district water management plan. So I was very proud of our team and had one of the best teams I've ever worked for. It was worked with. One day I told him, I kind of see y'all are all consultants with all these expertise. I had the smartest team. And I said, I'm just trying to make sure you have everything that you need to, it's kind of a servant leader, trying to make sure you have everything you need to do your job the way you need to do it.
Yeah, it sounds to me intuitively that is a really smart way to go about doing something like that that can be as contentious as I'm assuming that it would have been, and also that they still are when it comes to especially regional water supply plans and things like that.
Right.
Was there a noticeable difference? I mean, maybe you heard it from Henry at the time, which is like, oh my gosh, this is so much better than doing the other, which is like, here's a thing. And then you have stand up on stage and people yell at you for 3 or 4 hours and then you feel bad and you go, everybody feels bad. Yeah. You go home. I mean, was there a sense from Henry, from others, from the community that, hey, this is a whole lot better because people feel, you know, like they're a part of the process rather than the subject of it.
Yes, I think so. And that led to, I got a call from one of my intergovernmental coordinators one day, and he had just seen a presentation by a guy from out west, and he also was involved with Alabama and their racial issues and coming up with their integration plan that they were mandated to do. So he's been in the hottest of hottest places.
Sure.
And he heard this guy talking about processes he was using, because this was pretty new stuff to me. What we were doing was pretty basic. So we had Carl Moore, I remember him showing up in his Birkenstocks and shorts and turquoise jewelry, and I'm like, oh my goodness. And he taught, we had, oh gosh, maybe 20 people in the district in different departments trained in this collaborative problem solving. And we used those techniques to help with when the Wakaiva Parkway was put through. Mm-hmm. We helped with St. John's River Plan. We did for Mayor John Delaney. He was really into helping the St. John's, and we had a workshop. We had 17 facilitators, 400 people show up at the big center there to come up with some solutions for the St. John's River. So we used these techniques all over. A lot of them, we also used vision techniques where we would go in and get communities to envision really what they want things to look like, and powerful tools. And I've used those throughout my entire career. I've done some private consulting in that area. But when I left, and that was a hard thing to do, it really was more family oriented because I was driving an hour and 15 minutes, you know, each one way.
I was going to ask what that commute's like.
It was a lot through the forest. You know, I just felt like I needed to be closer to home. But I remember the head of our tech department coming to me when I left, and he said, you know, you being on our executive team has just changed everything so much to get people to approach things. We got a bunch of silver haired gorillas around the table. And I think I was one of two women that was on the leadership team at the time. And I just never really thought about that. But I think collectively, there was kind of this energy that everybody really caught on to this. And it wasn't me, it was a lot of people who caught on to this.
Sure.
And Putnam County called us one day. They were doing a vision plan. I found the copy of this plan the other day that's in my archives, but it really was a good time.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation.
If you don't mind, I'm probably going to press like fast forward or the warp on the timeline a bit. It's like, but I thought, and I want to talk about the Ocklawaha River, you know, and the Rodman Dam and all of that. But before we do that, I mean, there are going to be a lot of folks out there that don't know anything about, you know, the Ocklawaha or the St. John's River, cross-border barge canal. Can you help paint first like a mental picture for folks that are listening as to a little bit of the history? Because I know you know it backwards and forward. A little bit of the history of the barge canal, what its purpose was, what they thought it was supposed to be in terms of, you know, benefits, et cetera. And then we'll move on to where we are at this point in terms of dealing with it didn't, you know, it didn't get finished. And here's the outcome when you're looking decades later.
Yeah. So back in the 60s, and you got to think there were also the work they did on straightening the Kissimmee and the Everglades, all that work. The Corps was very big at that time on, you know, recovering swampland and making it. It's just a whole different mindset than we have today.
Sure.
So in the 60s, there was this idea, a pretty basic idea. If you think about the Panama Canal, it's like Florida's a long state. If I want to take a barge from one side to the other, it's a long trip. Mm-hmm. So let's just cut straight across, and that'll save time and be an economic boon, and it'll help our Placid, it'll help Ocala. The Ocala Chamber at the time was very big on that. So that was the idea. And what Marjorie Harris Carr from Gainesville, her husband was on the faculty at UF, very well known, into turtle studies and stuff. And her background was science too, very sharp woman. She got a group of scientists together, and they basically said, you're cutting right through the best aquifer in the state. Mm. And if you have oil spills or you have problems, you could destroy some of the best water supply in the state. So Nixon halted it. It got built in 68, I believe, and shortly thereafter, after a lot of haranguing, Nixon halted it.
Which, so you have the two that I know. So you have the Rodman Dam, you have is it Inglis Lock, right?
Yeah.
Is that, and the Inglis Lock is still there, isn't it?
Yeah. So they started building, they did about 30% of the project, somebody told me. So on each end, on the West Coast and the East Coast and Placa. I don't know that much about the other side. We haven't really focused on that much.
Sure.
But it's similar. It created a good fishing spot. But it is different in some ways from ours. But I think eventually they'll be looking at doing something too.
Yeah, I mean, and tell me, I guess, to that end, it's been the subject of conversation for as long as I've been around state government, which is 25 years now. I remember like the first year or two, this is an issue, but it always revolved around the Rodman Dam, not the West Coast, not necessarily in terms of, hey, what do you do about this thing? Can you talk about, I guess, that area? Because it's something that passes very close to Silver Springs, even where the state park is. And then you have the Rodman Dam. Can you describe the Rodman Dam? Because I think maybe the largest point of contention for a lot of folks and is Wang's like, what do you do with this thing? It's not in great shape. You're spending, the state taxpayers are spending money,
right.
You know, on maintaining it for what purpose, you know, and then we get to the, what do you do about that?
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to just say quickly,
this
is a big system. It starts at Lake Apopka, goes through the Harris Chain of Lakes, which is part of the Ocklawaha, comes down past Silver Springs. Silver Springs provides the majority of the water. Mm-hmm. One time it was as high as probably 66%. I think it's more like half of it right now. So Silver Springs was greatly affected by this. And then it goes down to near Palatka, where the dam was put. And there was a lock system put through where even when you had the dam, you could still get boats through the lock. Some manatees are making it through. We've had a few get killed along the way. Fish, not so much. They're not attracted to this very stagnant don't go where the water don't flow, as somebody tells me. But anyway, but you don't see the fish migration has really been cut off pretty dramatically. But it's created the big rub, I don't think, is as much the dam. There's reference to it being pulled out. It's not going to be totally pulled out. It's a 7,000 feet earthen berm. Mm-hmm. It's going to be broken through on one side, like a section of that, where the natural river was. So all the infrastructure, the overpass, the boat ramp, the restrooms will be there. The big rub is you have this big reservoir, open lake reservoir, that was a hugely popular bass fishing place. It's lost some of its reservoirs do that. They lose some of their productivity. It's not used as much. A lot of people I know won't go into it because it's this stump forest that was pulverized down into the ground is notorious about ripping off props. And so unless you really know what you're doing, a lot of people won't take a nice boat in there. But this still has a following, and they still have tournaments and things. And it's very much some people, that's all they know. One of the biggest guides, his grandfather was a guide. So, you know, there's family history and memories that have been formed there.
Before we get, I want to get more into those details, but I want to circle back to, you know, largely what I do with, you know, with this podcast is learn about, you know, people themselves. And so when did you start getting involved with this issue, which is like, and describe for me what it is, like your vision for what it looks like. Is it the restoration of the Ocklawaha River or the restoration of all natural systems, you know, that throughout, you know, your part of the universe there in Marion County?
Yeah, to me, I see this as a significant system. It's got four ecosystems: Silver Springs, the Ocklawaha, the St. John's, and it affects the Atlantic fishery. So at 12 counties, a lot of local folks, they see it as a Putnam. It's been kind of positioned as a Putnam County issue, even though Marion County shares the same acreage almost on the reservoir. But that's what attracted, I mean, I'm very closely tied to Silver Springs, and I've seen Silver Springs just totally be, Silver Springs is still a beautiful place to visit, but if you look underneath and you talk to the boat drivers who have been out there for decades, and the guys that clean the boats, the dive team, and the people that have been there all our lives, we've seen the fish disappear basically and be taken over by tilapia and armored catfish and so forth.
Interesting.
So I think in all fairness, I have a really strong heart for Silver Springs, but I do see this entire system as being important, and I think that's what attracts it to me. So my brother John was my kind of hero and everything, and in his retirement years, he was apparently, and I didn't realize this, working with some business people. I never found out who those people were, because he died before I really knew about this. But he was working with some business people to come up with a solution that was acceptable to Putnam County business community. And my son told me that. He told me I'm doing the GIS mapping for him, and I don't know really what he's trying to do, but I'll show you the maps I did for him. And so I found this out the week he was you know, he's been had a stroke, was on his deathbed, and I just told him, I don't know what you're doing, but I'm going to try to figure out and see if I can jump in and help. So that got me. When I make a commitment like that, it weighs on me. And I tried to do. I was at Duke Energy running their grants program for the state, which was really interesting work, and I was trying to do some things long distance from St. Pete, and working with at that time some of the nonprofit groups and things were just not moving for me, and I was frustrated. I didn't have time to commit to it. It just didn't seem like the momentum was there. The approach was not exactly what I kind of knew how he worked, and how he worked, it was all about collaboration, getting people to the table, coming up with shared solutions, and thinking about, you know, I call it the shoes test. Put yourself in, you know, Sean Rush, one of the guys' shoes, and how he's looking at what can we do to make sure if this changes, how his livelihood's not going to be impacted. That's important to me. I don't get credit for that with the Putnam County folks a lot of times, but That's very much of a focus of how I work.
Well, I mean, do that for me a little bit, you know, if you don't mind. Give me the steel man argument for maintaining the status quo.
I think, you know, it has been a viable fishery, and some of the opposition are anglers, not all of them, though. Mm-hmm. And you have some, there's only 16 landowners that actually own the waterfront. That's kind of, people think there's hundreds, but it's mostly greenway land. Mm-hmm. There's maybe another 80 or something that use the greenway lands for their docks and stuff, so they feel like they are, own it. And then there's people, you know, live within a few miles or whatever.
Sure.
And have recreated there. It's where they've done picnic. When you go out to the dam on the weekends, there's a I made myself go out there and spend a lot of time there because I wanted to get a feel for how people used that space and what was important to them. And you had on one side of the park families, mostly people of color, picnicking with the cane poles and having a lot of fun, no infrastructure, hardly a terrible porta potty, no picnic area, rutty road, but they were still having, they still have a great time and have a beautiful little river there that would still be there with restoration. And then on the other side, primarily you've got a lot of bank fishermen, subsistent fishermen. The fish come up there. I call it the honey hole. I've watched them. I've watched a guy that knows what he's doing pull out major bass, like multiples within a couple of hours. So,
wow.
But the fish is the weirdest phenomena. They literally come up there stacked up in like little soldiers, depending on different times of year. Sometimes it's the stripes. Sometimes it's the shad. They still instinctively, after all these years, want to get to the other side and be in the reservoir. But it makes for great fishing there. And some of those people, that is their dinner. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So you've got to take into consideration these families. You've got to take consideration when you're looking at what you're going to do with the system.
You've got, in this, as I want to get to, shoe testing it for me post breach of the dam. As I think you said, there's no, as far as I know, there's no idea to take the whole thing down. It'd also be incredibly expensive, but you do have legislation right now. I think it's House Bill 981. Is that?
Yes.
Right?
House Bill 981 and Senate Bill 1066.
Right.
1066.
And so 981 passed, I think, near unanimously, right?
107-3.
Right. And the Senate one is languishing. I think you and I talked briefly about that part before we started recording. What does that do? And then kind of shoot test that for me for those same folks that we're talking about,
right?
You know, from that perspective.
So I don't know how many, I've been at this for 6 years, and I don't know, I can tell you the exact year that they like clicked in with me, but I think it was a year or two into it, I realized we can't just do restoration. We've got to build in a recreation component because there are some ramps that'll be out of water, so you've got to extend the ramps. You need to figure out, make sure you've got shore fishing places. They may not look exactly, it won't look exactly like, but you've got to think of, you take this big reservoir down to a river, those wide open fishermen, it's a different type of fishermen, they like the wide open, they're going to probably migrate to the St. John's more. So we need to make sure the ramps and the things in the St. John's are up to speed, okay? So recreation, we've got to do this outdoor recreation stuff, and I'll come back to that a little bit. And the third thing is, even though the economists show in 20 years, you'll see $200 million in economic benefits, the optics are scary to Putnam County. You've got one of the poorest counties in the state, and Representative Judson did a plea for that on the House floor this week. And so even though this reservoir hasn't, it's helped economically, it's less now than it was, the St. John's is really the golden goose. That's where the big national tournaments are. So this dam is hurting the golden goose, but people don't make that, all people don't agree or make that connection.
Right.
So we also said we should put an economic development package in there. So we call it the 3 R's, sometimes the 4 R's, we'll throw in resiliency because of the dam safety issue. But it took me a while, really, to get everybody. The conservation community actually has been great about this idea. I started talking about this quite a few years ago. UF students did some wonderful images of what different options, how that could look. I walked them down to the dam reservoir. I said, whatever you design, it has to be better than what you're looking at right now. Mm-hmm. And then they looked at canoe trails, they looked at driving tours, they looked at manatee viewing sites down at Silver Springs. There were 14 students that we worked with for a whole term. And then we shopped those out. We did focus groups with the students, with fishermen and different people. This is during COVID, so we're doing it online, most of it. Yeah. And then after COVID lifted, we did workshops in the community, getting people to weigh in on these designs. But this three-part package, people laugh at me because I'm like the, you know, constant, we've got to include this. Mm-hmm. And Brodeur and Duggan, they get it. Mm-hmm. This is what we've got on this package is something that's never been put on the table this year. It was always just restoration, which is good. I mean, that's great. We're going to increase this great, but sure, put the people aspect in there too, and look at how it's impacting a whole bunch of different type of stakeholders.
I mean, people use the term, you know, changing hearts and minds sometimes. How much of that have you seen when you add in those aspects of it, not just, hey, we're going to knock down this dam and you get a river? What has been the reaction? I know you still, obviously, there are still folks on both sides,
right,
of the issue.
Right.
As you said, you know, there's, you know, representatives on the floor concerned about what they're concerned about. What has been, have you seen maybe a shift in attitudes about that?
I believe well, Marin County was kind of agnostic about this issue, which was frustrating to me. And they finally, through a lot of outreach and talking to officials, understand the connection between Silver Springs and the Ocklawaha. Putnam, the polling on both Putnam and Marion, Barcelo did some polling a few years back for us, 77% of Marion County in favor of restoration. And in Putnam, it was 74. We were surprised. But the percent that were pro-dam was under 10%. So, but we have some pretty vocal people that are opposed to it. So you can't, but we have pulled people along. I have my board president and vice president are both former Putnam County officials. One was tax collector and county commissioner. And really showing them this package is what got them on board. Hmm. And one of the challenges is people won't listen. People get dug in. I won't mention names, but one particular senator, before we were even able to explain what the package we were thinking and how that would work, kind of drew the line in the sand. Mm. So if you don't listen, it's hard to get there. People won't come to, they won't come to workshops with students and give their input. It's hard to get there. And so there are certain people that we always still try to bring people in, but if they won't sit down and talk to you or participate in workshops, it's hard to come to any kind of consensus.
I mean, you know, obviously, it's like, I know you've probably done it long enough and, you know, been around, you know, these things long. The political considerations or constituent, you know, considerations are a fraught universe that these folks, elected officials, especially even local, seem like especially, and then also obviously state and federal as well. And so it seems like, you know, for a lot of them, there's getting to that point. But I think, you know, in my mind, it's like, I want to hear you talk about what in terms of the willingness along the way to form new compromises. You know, you talked about economic aspects of that. Are there folks where it's like, hey, this was the thing that turned it for, you know, some, you know, Putnam County commissioners or some Marion County commissioners to be less agnostic and more in favor?
Yeah, so one of the county commissioners in Marion County, he had already kind of been out. Once you've kind of staked your position out there with a bunch of people, it's very hard to walk it back.
Right.
He was kind of in that position, very respectful. I have so much respect for people who sit down and talk and, you know, disagree on this or what. That's great. But at the end, he said, I just don't know that I won't be able to change my position, but this package is really not that bad. He said, I really like what you've done. And to me, that's a win. It's not a total win, but it's a win. And I want to talk about the governor's staff. So last year, you know, we've gotten two vetoes from the governor, but that was not for this package. It was totally, one was a study 2 years ago. The last one was just to get restoration going. His staff's had a lot of input. And good input. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that came up with the idea of having an advisory council to help shape the recreation package. That's great, because we put together, from just workshops and talking to people,
right,
you know, potential projects. But you need somebody to say, if you've got $25 million for recreation, what are the biggest priorities? Mm-hmm. And that should not be our board. It should be the community. So that, and also just kind of gets in the weeds, but we had it attached to ERP permit that's been in abeyance and an old EIS, and there was a feeling you don't want to get that locked in. There could be new data that would shift some thinking on that. We didn't have, back when the EIS was done, there was virtually no manatees coming up in the Silver Springs, for instance. So we gave some give and take with the governor's office on that. And I think we have a better bill because of it. And that's how that should work.
Yeah.
That's how things should work.
And I guess that was the question I was going to get to, is like, give me the two separate paths, like in the choose your own adventure at this point. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the House bill that has passed, it's either that or something very similar to that fundamentally passes. Is that something that the most number of people, you know, can live with? Can you and your organization live with it? And on the other side, absent this happening, what type of work are y'all engaged in trying to do restoration work in these systems, absent that kind of restoration in and around the reservoir itself?
Well, the way this would roll out, and it's, if you weren't in the trenches on the bill development, it's sometimes hard to kind of read between the lines, but the way it will work is there will be an advisory council. It's charged with developing an outdoor recreation plan, the economic development program, and this is the thing that's one sentence people miss: identify transition issues and recommendations for solutions. For instance, there's a report from the district says there might be a few wells, maybe five, six that drop 10 feet. Not a lot, but it's still significant. Mm-hmm. So there are other dam projects we've looked a lot around the state where you can set up a fund that will address things like that. So that's that committee would be charged with those three things. So you'll have a year and a half of getting that all together while simultaneously DEP and their team get up-to-date data, refresh the plan, get it ready to go, any permits that need updating. And so it will be community driven. You've got representatives from Marion and Putnam and Clay and St. John's that'll be on this group. I think that's a marvelous idea. And give kudos to the governor's team for coming up with the advisory council idea. And so then the restoration plan might get tweaked a little bit, but there'll be two aspects of recreation, which one is state-owned lands from the dam all the way to Silver Springs, improving the ramps, making sure they're still usable. You got more manatees coming up there. How are you going to, you got a viewing area. You want to do something like Three Sisters, or take one of the newly opened or two of the open springs, make them suitable for habitat. So you'll have the restoration plan and you'll have these state lands. In Marion County, a lot of them are run by Marion County, not the same in Putnam. And then the other thing that I love is a grants program for four counties, Marion, Putnam, St. John's, and Clay, where we could improve the ramps and things on the St. John's that are probably get more use from certain types of fishermen. I love river fishing. It's kind of romantic to me and relaxing, but everybody has, you know, what they love. Sure.
Before I get into some closing questions, I ask the same thing, well, similar to almost every guest. How can people learn more about what you're up to? If they want to get involved, they can get involved. How do they do that?
So we do have a great website, GreatFloridaRiverwayTrust.org. You can see the updates on the bills and things like that. That is my group, my board. We've got the local latest press up there. We hope to have a link to you this. And then there's a group of conservation orgs that have Reunite the Rivers. And I actually started that group and broke off from them because I felt like I needed more focus on the business and the recreation, all that. But they have a wonderful site that has a tour of the system so you can see where it goes. And you can also see a old documentary, fact sheets, all that. And all of those groups that are involved have different things. They do a lot of things at the microbreweries. It's just a great place to get people together. They're always doing outreach activities. So I encourage people to get involved.
We'll definitely put both of those on the episode notes for this, and people can go find it there. Also, I guess just watch the news. Although I'm sure, like, whatever's in there, I'm guessing. I've been to the website once, and I've seen a few of the articles, and so you're pretty up to date. I see a lot of websites where the most recent article is like 2 years old. And yours is not like that. I'm gonna take you as an optimist, and so I think I know the answers, like, but I ask them anyway, which is, are you optimistic about the future? And I'll say the environment in Florida, but you can dial it into those four ecosystems that you're talking about here.
I am optimistic about Florida. And the reason is, if you look at referendums for land acquisition, whatever, things that are on the ballot, they're running over 70%, 80%. So what that tells me, the environmental conservation stuff is not going to be successful unless it's bipartisan. And that has been a big mantra of mine for a long, long time. And I think we see that in the legislature. Governor's done a lot for the Everglades, and Broder are so committed to this. I mean, people tell me they've never seen any leadership so committed to a bill as this. And because it makes sense, not just from the conservation standpoint, but from the economic standpoint. So there's frustrations. I mean, there's things that aren't moving as fast as they could. And we're growing. So it's very hard when you're growing as fast as we are. And things like the Wildlife Corridor, things like this project, you don't have to buy any land. You can restore a whole bunch of stuff without buying a single piece of land. Mm. So I think, I call it the green infrastructure. We've got set aside, whether it's full fee acquisition, less than fee conservation, I think it needs to be some of both. And we have to protect, it's not just the land, we've got to protect the springs and the things and it takes everybody working together. And one of the things way back, we had it was kind of just a come to Jesus meeting, I guess, on Lake Weir when I first got started, and I said, there were about four or five rules. One was, you can't beat up on the governor and the agencies that are going to make this happen and get it done. You've got to be working with them. And that was one of my brother's number one rule. And of course, he worked on the agency side as well. You got to have a big tent. You can't do it without, I got helped get a park acquisition referendum, land acquisition in Marin County. And we open it up to recreation, and that's how it passed, by 2%. It passed 52% because we allowed for baseball fields and things. So, I've always said, so have we got any business people involved? We got business people right now doing outreach to Senator Albritton and folks on how important it is to hotels and how important it is to grass-fed beef place. And, so big tent. I love your title, but I don't like war language. I hate to say the word opposition. I'm just a middle child. I can't help myself, but I feel like the press didn't help this for years. It was always a fight. It'll be a fight the next week. You just wait. But it's always couched in terms of war language, I call it. The county commissioner from Putnam was there this week, right after the House. He was so gracious, came over and we talked about things we both cared about, which is pretty much water and wildlife and all those things, and that we're just looking at doing it in different ways, So I just feel like there's some fundamental ways of doing business that'll get you further in conservation areas. And I think if we can do it that way, and I hope this is successful because we tried to do everything right. But, you know, I think whether we cross the line this year, I think we've set the foundation for this project. And but I also hope, and I say this all the time, that we've set some framework for how you can do things a little differently. You know, I hope there's lessons learned. I'm not saying we're perfect beast or anything, but I feel like we've really tried to do things in different ways.
Yeah, I think some of those strategies really make sense in my mind, which is, you know, somebody that spent 20 years in government, you know, the idea that, you know, to make, you know, enemies out of these, you know, 160 folks in that building or folks in the governor's office or these agencies are just human beings, you know, trying to do what they can. And so it doesn't make any sense to approach from that standpoint. So I think that's really wise on your part. What advice, because I'm not, it's like I usually ask about what keeps you up at night. It's like, I think you covered it, but I know you lean into the optimistic side. And even though it's like, I just like the title, Water, because I like Mark Twain.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So you discover that, as with this one, it's like, I don't like doing, you know, a lot of arguing, you know, with folks about it. It's more of, I find it counterproductive, you know, to find out what people are thinking by yelling at them as well. And so I'll skip that and go to, and I think you dipped into a little bit. It's like, but maybe address younger people that are looking to, they see something, you know, like you did, and they, it's like, hey, I want to get involved in, whether it's, you know, as a vocation and getting into the environmental sphere, or just finding their path in terms of how do you advocate for something you care about.
Well, I describe my internships that I had, or they were really OPS jobs, but one of my favorite thing I've done with this work is working with students. We had that group of UF students. I've had several, we're just a little group. We're all volunteer group. We're not developers. Some people keep saying we're in bed with the developers. If you said that in Marin County, they'd laugh you out. If you said Margaret Spontek's in bed with the developers, you would get laughed out of town. I'll just tell you that. But I think I've had a chance to have some interns, and those things are a two-way street. You got to find the right person to hook up with in an agency that will do an internship or an organization. But you can both work to make that the best you can do. And I've really worked hard with the folks. I think if you have an intern, you owe them to try to help them find a position. That happened for me in Tallahassee. And that kind of set the stage for me on that. But I think students getting out there volunteering is a great way to get to know going to conferences.
Yeah.
And some will offer student rates. The University of Florida has the Water Conference that just took place. They have an annual public interest environmental conference. I mean, there are a lot of people that will take youth under their wings and work with them.
Is that, I mean, it's funny. It's like when you say, like, you know, most people look at it as like, you just take whatever you can get. I think I'm hearing you say, maybe be a little choosy. Make sure that, you know, if you are going to intern, that it's something that's where someone's also investing in you and your future. Is that, did I capture that right?
Yeah, and I think it's sit down before you take that leap with whoever you're going to work with and talk about what your goals are, what you want to learn, so that person can help you. I always ask people, what's important to you? What do you want to learn? Well, you know, what do you want to be? Mm-hmm. All those things, so I can try to kind of massage what the work so they can get that kind of experience.
Margaret Spontek, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I totally enjoyed it. Thanks.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod. And you can reach me directly at flwaterpod@gmail.com with your comments and suggestions. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for this podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free, and you should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me for more amazing conversations with the people who have helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State and beyond sometimes. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer. Thank you.